Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Moms Plus One Dad Versus Management. Really happy to be here today talking to you all. My name is Maria Jadis. I'm the CEO and founder of Hot Studio, which is an experience design company based in San Francisco and New York. And I've been managing people as a CEO and founder for over 20, probably close to 25 years. In just various roles of my career. And I've been a mom for approximately 12 of those years. And when I was, one day I was contemplating, I had an epiphany where an employee was yelling at me, like really yelling at me. And I remember going, okay, I'm going into my Zen state. I'm going to remain calm. I'm going to talk in a calm voice. I completely turned into this mother to deal with the problem. And I realized that so much of management and parenting completely overlap. And if I could apply some parenting skills to the way I manage people, well, not only is it fun because I feel like it's like a dirty little secret, but I find that you get some great results. And, you know, parents are children are not your employees and vice versa, but there's a ton of overlap that I'd like to explore today with my esteemed panel. And evidence about parenting first of all, let's figure out how many people are hungover. Probably a lot of you. Well, if you're parents, you're just used to being hungover. But is anybody pregnant or wants to disclose the fact that they're pregnant?
For the first time?
For the first time. The pregnant people stand up. Yay, okay. Pregnant people.
Yay.
Okay.
Hopefully you're not
standing.
Hungover.
Stay standing. How many people have at least one child? Those people stand up. Anybody who has children, stand up. Okay. So if you have, if you're pregnant, you could sit down. We applauded you already. if you just have one kid, sit down. Okay. How about two kids? It's getting interesting. How about three kids? Ah, you all have three kids. All right, well, we bow to you for your courage. And who are the three? Because I have presents. You know, it's nothing like a parent without rewards. So who's the other one? Okay. Thank you.
It's a little high in the glycemic index.
So anyway, this is a photograph of the books on my bookshelf. And so, as I said, I've been managing people for over 25 years. How many management books have I read personally? I buy them. I don't really read them. They bore me to tears. But look at all of the parenting books. As soon as you get pregnant, somehow you become obsessed with reading books about parenting. And it's amazing, like when once you're pregnant, you're like, holy shit, now what? And then you have these books that tell you exactly how you're going to feel every month. From conception to, from the moment you find out that you're pregnant to the time that you give birth. And then you have books on what to expect for the first year, what to expect for the second year. It's an amazing textbook on how to deal with children as they grow up. And I thought, wow, if you look through the books that you have, you're going to pick up a lot of great management advice. So I'd like to introduce my esteemed panel of parents and managers. We're going to start with the token dad, Mike.
Lowercase dad.
Yes. We actually needed a little bit more estrogen on the panel, so we asked Mike to join us.
I'm very proud of my estrogen levels.
Yes. And Mike is the VP of Product Design at SAP, but we're going to let his two children, explain what he does for a living.
So he is designing software for companies and people who work in those companies their lives much easier.
He designs, he and his team designs a well-built, user-friendly system
to aid them in whatever business they're doing, like travel agent where you can affect pretty much scan your receipts in and all that, and it would calculate totals. It's pretty much organize everything for business trips. Mm-hmm. Very useful product.
I did not tell them.
A very useful product indeed.
There's a funny story why they know that, because I gave them one of my presentations, and I figured if my kids could understand it, then my CEO could understand it. And they nailed it, and that's kind of cool.
And the second esteemed panelist is my pal, Lourdes Alba, who's the manager of Pixar. We actually did share parenting, share care together with my second, her first. And we actually realized that we liked each other a lot more than we liked the nanny. So we've been friends for 9 years now.
9 years.
And here's her daughter, Malia, telling us what her mom does for a living.
Guest starring Olivia's Olivia.
I think my mom's job is to tell people what to do. She manages different apartments. What does that mean, managing?
It's like somebody tells her something, and I think she tells the person what the person wants her to tell them.
Doesn't fit on my business card, but that's...
Third panelist is Margaret Stewart, who's the director of user experience, and she's another brave soul who has 3 children.
She's the director of user experience at YouTube.
What does that mean?
She and her team conduct qualitative and quantitative research to assess the efficacy of her team's user interface designs.
What does that mean?
She makes YouTube look pretty.
Yay, pretty!
And then finally, my daughter, Olivia, who you saw in a previous appearance, will be introducing and describing what I do for a living. Oh, no.
Oh.
The sound's not working.
But the dealy boppers are.
Oh. Let's see. I know. Hang on. Let's see if I could do it this way. Oh.
Can you, if you unplug,
Your sound is on her computer.
Oh, she's so funny.
Oh, there you go.
No, that's just on the computer.
But can you put the mic up? It's better than nothing, right?
Oh, that's a cool idea.
It's old school.
It's good.
It's old school.
Okay, ready?
Start it over.
All right. What's with video these days? Is this on? Okay, ready? This we're going old school.
What do I do for a living?
You are a designer. You teach in Hawaii and at the California University.
At the university.
The college?
Wait,
California College of Arts.
Maria Cudies has pursued a vision to build her intelligent, elegant, people-centered design throughout her professional life. It's an approach that helps her grow into a full-service creative agency with offices in San Francisco and New York City.
In 2012, she was named an AIGA Fellow Teen
and is the co-author and designer of several award-winning books.
Pretty amazing!
Yeah!
Worth it.
Yes, thank you. Was that worth it?
Yes.
Okay. So we have a full, we have so much content. My job is to kind of stay on task because we could take one topic and spend an hour talking about it. But basically, we've broken the discussion into these four themes that each one of us is going to be moderating. This notion of fair versus equal, collaboration, cooperation, dealing with conflict, problem children, and learning from failure. And we have a couple of ground rules. So we have the four panelists, four themes. We're going to be talking largely around managing, but we will slip into parenting, and we might throw in a little bit of work-life balance to mix it up. But feel free to ask any questions of us, and provide, or you can provide your own advice. So we could always learn from other people in the room. And then no whining, bitching, or moaning about your own children. We'll do that later with the margaritas. And then we have presents for showing up today. So I will be passing around candy.
And Marie, are we going to hold questions until the end?
Yes, yeah. We're going to we're going to hold questions until the last 10 minutes of the session. Sound good? You feel like you want to be here? Okay, all right. Okay, anybody who's like, I'm not even a parent, why the fuck am I here? You can leave now, but you will miss out on the present. Yeah, go ahead.
Sit down.
Oh, look, the dad came out. See? Yeah. I told you.
Fair and equal.
Yes. So we're going to start with Mike. Pretty much on time.
Does dad treat you the same?
Oh, wait.
Or differently from one another?
I think he treats us relatively the same.
Yeah. That's not working.
And obviously, he can't treat us identically the same, but just... There's no, like of one kid, dislike of another.
And it just wouldn't be right, so to speak.
We're different people, obviously, but we get treated fairly the same.
Is he fair?
I would say, definitely.
Yes.
He's a relatively fair man. Unless it comes down to the last slice of chocolate. There's no room for bargaining there.
Is he equal?
Between us and him, or us?
Do you think he treats...
Until it comes down to the chocolate.
Does he treat you equally?
No, wait. Us equally, yes.
Yes, he definitely treats us equally. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And what do you see the difference between fair and equal?
Well, fair would be we're treated not wrong. We're not being...
Karma. We do something wrong, we get punished for that. And the other twin, having done nothing wrong, doesn't get punished just to make it balanced.
Yeah, we're two different people.
And then equal?
Equal would be the same.
For example, I were to get a meal, and we would get the same portion of the meal, because
they're both meals, and it's right to
a meal. Yes.
So you feed them.
So here is my prop. Here is the equal portion. Both get T-shirts that are identical, but there's differentiation with color. It often limits the cool stuff that you'd love to be able to do because you know the kid would really just love that. But the other kid would be bummed if he didn't get that. And we've worked very hard to differentiate, not dress them alike, though you see the gag there. They're identical twin boys. And
they are? Didn't notice.
They totally are. And they were so identical, we had to paint one toenail red and the other toenail of the other kid blue. And red and blue have been their colors since that age. So there is an equal portion to that. But as they grow and as they develop, they really began to differentiate themselves from a personality standpoint. But they really loved a lot of the same things. And I found, to Maria's point, this was sort of an epiphany for me. How do you deal with kids who look the same but behave and act differently? How do you reward, recognize them? How do you really understand and appreciate their qualities uniquely? Sometimes they mature or may get their head around some things faster than the other guy. What happens when they cross a boundary? How do you punish without making life miserable for everyone? You know, if one of the boys, didn't follow the line of thinking that we had discussed. Someone loses video game time, perhaps. The other kid's watching video game or playing video games. It becomes a really tough dynamic in the household. Those are similar, but perhaps less obvious in the workplace. When you're dealing with individuals from the first time you hire them, what are you looking for? What are the qualities that differentiate them? What are their talents and strengths? And how do you to build on those? So it requires a great deal of empathy. You got to care about the individual and their career path. And so first and foremost, it's about that. With that foundation, the analogy or the corollary with the boys or my kids becomes strong. I care about where they go. I also know that they're on a different development curve than a professional would be. But at the same time, they struggle with a lot of the same issues, and I've seen professionals struggle with as well. How do they shift from one technology to another, one approach to another? At some point, we become very comfortable with our knowledge, and we want to maximize that. But when the ground is shifting underneath you all the time, going from Flex to HTML5, how do you begin to adapt? What happens when that new hire has that skill and you don't? How does the manager recognize those differences but reward equally? Mm-hmm. These are the questions I'm constantly asking. So being able to identify the strengths and weaknesses of the person, put them in a situation where their strengths can thrive, and when they cross boundaries, hopefully having it be recognized by them first and managed by them first, and only when it becomes irreconcilable that you then sit down as a manager. So this comes down to a framework that I've sort of applied at home. Sounds over-analytical, but when you have twins, I mean, we had everything up on whiteboards, and we had to know when they were being fed so we didn't feed the one guy twice and the other guy once, right? Fair and equal. And the meal thing was right on the money. So we're very clear about our communication and expectation. We say, this is what we expect, but what do you expect? And we make sure that we're aligned with that. And then we say, when things don't begin to go wrong, we'll have a discussion about that, but it won't be emotional. We'll try to keep it as, you know, Mr. Rogers as possible. And then we say, what can we do to change it? So we try to be as data-driven as possible. Again, sounds, hey, my wife's Italian-American, so it used to be a yelling in the household, but not so much now, because it's really about how do we realize that these kids are on different journeys. And that's true with the employee. So what I'd like to do is sort of pose the differentiation question to the panel.
Mm-hmm. We'll start with Lourdes. We have 3 minutes.
How do your employees, how do you capture their strengths and talents and recognize that in the workplace?
Well, you know, at Pixar, we're a fairly open environment. And so whenever I start working with someone, I sit down with them immediately and we talk about what their interests are and what they've just done, what project they just completed, what their role was, things that they wish that they had done on that project, what they would like to do on the next project. And we try to have a mutual agreement about what they're going to set out to do over the course of their stint on our films. Our projects are... they're long-term projects, so as opposed to maybe some of the maybe client work that the agencies might run into, a film sometimes will run 5 years. So I could be working with someone for 3 years. They're marathons, they're not sprints, and so we try to set up for the arc of the time that they're on the project what it is that they want to try to develop out of that. So I think a lot of it is conversation and taking into account, you know, some people, I think... the differentiation question is something that's really critical, because I think people communicate differently and operate differently. And I think part of my job is to adapt the way that I work with people to sort of match that person's style, to sort of discover myself what I think that person can do, wants to do. And we do a lot of work with our HR group, and we have senior managers that sort of look over everyone's growth, and so we try to make sure that we're setting people up for success as they go. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I think one of the things that's interesting about this topic is, for me, I feel like it's really important to be fair and equal over the long run, but to not get necessarily too caught up day to day and having everything kind of be even Steven. And the fact is that people's work will kind of go in peaks and valleys, and some people will, you know, have a period of time where they're, you know, highly productive and doing great work, and then other times, you know, maybe it'll be a little bit more of a time of introspection or whatever. And, you know, I also feel like when you're looking at the team as a whole, when you have, you know, somebody with performance issues, to not necessarily have that be masked, obviously, by, like, you know, let's keep everybody kind of on the same playing field. I remember one time coaching somebody who was a performance issue on a team I was managing, and he said, "I think you have a bias. You know, you're biased in how you look at the team." I said, "Yeah, well, I'm really biased towards, like, highly talented and productive people." Guilty as charged.
Yes.
So I think it's interesting, you know, it's like to kind of build that ethic of kind of recognizing who's really good at what, and putting them in the right context with the right combination of people so that they can, as often as possible, be in that place. But also to recognize when you're actually just dealing with deficits and performance issues, because, you know, you can kind of let that situation drag on for a while before confronting it.
Mm-hmm. And the only thing I'd add before we move on is, as a manager and a parent, it's important to remember it's not about you. Mm-hmm. It's about them. And it's as a manager, it's your job to set them up for success. What are the things that you can set them up for success? What are their superpowers? Build those up. What's their kryptonite? How do you bring them around for them to either become superpowers, or that's just something that they shouldn't be doing because they would fail at it. So I think that's just, it's important that even though you're hiring people with a job description, doesn't necessarily mean that they're still an individual that has to perform that function, and you can't treat everybody the same. So the next theme is about collaboration and working in teams together, and it's called Play Nice in the Sandbox. And I'm going to start passing around the goodies ahead of time because I can tell you guys are really good.
Maybe a sandcastle together.
Full mountain.
Mountain together.
Hard.
You have to work all together, and sometimes it doesn't really work when you work all together.
Well, like, if someone wants it to be, like, just, like, a big, long thing, and someone wants it
to be,
like, just a skinny, tall thing, sometimes they can get in arguments.
Or, like, who's doing what sometimes.
If somebody wants it small, but the other person wants it tall.
Or, like, differences in what you're doing.
You might get in fights.
If you want to do it in the sun, but the other person wants to do it in the shade,
can we get in fights?
You guys, the tag would just join us, see?
What's great about that video is that last weekend I went into Pixar with a girlfriend, and she was going to edit the footage that I had been shooting over the last several weeks. And we got in there. I brought Malia and a couple of her friends because they like to come and play. And all the footage was corrupt, so we had to reshoot it in the moment. I thought something that was going to take us a couple hours would, you know, be easy to get through. We had to reshoot. So we went outside to find the girls, and we found them on the sand volleyball court making this mountain, which I thought was serendipitous. Worked out nicely for my title slide, but they were playing really nicely together, and I thought it was interesting as we were asking them, well, what are you doing, that they kept referencing this fighting thing, this, like, well, we can argue and we can fight, and that might be something that 8-year-old girls do frequently, but I think that it's also something that happens in our work sandbox. So I guess what I'd like to say about collaboration is that I think when you are asking people that you work with to collaborate on a project, you're asking them to think outside of themselves. You're asking them to remove their personal interests, their personal goals, and to think about the project or the goal over that, and to think about the other people that they work with, which I think is sometimes hard. And I find that the challenge in leading groups sometimes is coaching people through that. So I would like to ask our esteemed mm-hmm. panel their experiences about coaching and fostering collaborative environments in your individual sandboxes.
Well, you know, I had a couple weeks ago brought my team through a process of brainstorming and renewing our understanding of who you want to hire, because a lot of this for me gets back to hiring practices. If you get hiring right, almost everything else will fall into place over time. And we brainstormed literally like 200 post-it notes of all these different attributes of designers and researchers who do well and would do well within the context of YouTube. And the one attribute that we all somewhat cheekily agreed on was they must be a lover of kittens, which we didn't literally mean lover of kittens, but what that stood for was not taking yourself too seriously, being interested in the levity and the humor that our product, you know, often makes so popular, and also just like somebody who's like creative and fun to be around. And I think that that is something that we focus really a lot on, in particular in the creative fields. Having, you know, obviously we work really hard, but having time for teams to actually play together, to build those connections and appreciations for the different things that people bring to the table, and to not always be so project focused, because a lot of times it's in the downtime when you're playing that great ideas start to emerge. I know that's true for you guys at Pixar as well, and your creative process is so interesting for that reason. But a lot of ancillary activities that seem like sidelines, maybe not even related to the goal you're working towards, are crucial to making that collaboration work.
Mm-hmm. I think in my situation, my team works like a startup incubator inside of a really big enterprise software company, and I have designers, engineers, and business product managers, very different mindsets, very different approaches, and getting them to empathize with one another and care about that other person's point of view is critical. It's the DNA of how we're actually driving innovation. What I found, even in that situation, is sometimes it is around the tactical. We're a build-to-think team. We build tangible. That's evidence-based. And what I found in collaboration and collaboration environments, people can slip into talking and talking about things as opposed to being tangible. So we try to be thing-based. And when someone's not hitting it from a thing standpoint, it becomes obvious to everyone. And what our core philosophy is that teams deal with their stuff. Mm-hmm. We're team empowered. This is not the management overlay. So the first line is the team deals with it upfront, honestly. And that has to have a foundation of truth and trust in there without that. When that's not there, I have to intervene and I have to work with folks to build that trust, to really coach that person, to bring their talent out. We've go through a behavior-based interview process that's really fact-driven, not about what they aspire to, but what they've actually done. So I know the folks can do the work, but when there's a challenge, it typically tells me that there's somehow fear involved, or they may be feeling like they really don't know what their role is. So that's my job, is I make it clear, and I come in and I really cheerlead them, and I also take things off their table so they can have some successes early on and begin to move forward.
Mm-hmm. There's three things that I want to talk about. Well, Hot Studio is an agency, so we have clients. We design digital products and services for we create our own products, or we actually do them on behalf of clients. So it's a different kind of situation in that we have to collaborate. We collaborate. That's our culture as a company, but we also collaborate with our clients. And the way we do that successfully is we look at every single person in the room as a design partner. They all are coming at the same design problem with a different area of expertise and a different worldview. They're all treated equals in their own discipline. So that could be a subject matter expert. That can be an engineer. It could be a user experience architect, a visual designer, a business strategist. They'll speak different languages, and they're going to tackle the problem at the same time. So we really kind of try to enforce this issue that we're all being treated equal, including the client as a team member. And that really helps break down any kind of hierarchy through job title or client-vendor relationship. Secondly, I think the environment itself is incredibly critical for cooperation and collaboration. You have to create an environment that is going to let people express themselves. At Hot Studio, we have We have whiteboards. We have tables you can write on, post-it notes. We have all of these low-tack things that enable people who don't even define themselves necessarily as visual to get their ideas out. So I think the environment for collaboration is really important. And third, I just wanted to give a little bit of parenting advice because I think it's a brilliant tool for me, so I want to share it with you. So I have my two kids, Max, who's 11, and Olivia, who's 9, and I, you know, like every parent, you kind of control the amount of screen time your kids have. So Saturday mornings is always the day you wake up and watch cartoons. But I want to sleep. I want to sleep in for a day. You know, sleep in means 9 o'clock, right? But so I told them that they can wake up and they can watch TV until I wake up. Sorry. So they are forced to compromise because they have one TV. So they have to get up. They get up at like 6 or 7 because they know that they'll get a couple of hours in. And I tell them, if they start fighting, I'm going to come down, I'm going to wake up, I'm going to come down and shut the TV off. So that's just a great... So now they're like, holy shit, don't wake mom up. We have to agree. So, I don't know, try to do that in your own area of work. But it's a brilliant idea and you get a couple of hours of sleep.
So are we down to the last minute? I have one other thing to mention.
You go ahead, gotta be fast.
So the only other thing I wanted to mention was something that has worked for me in the past with groups, because I inherit groups from the studio. We cast people from a large net, and I put these groups together, and I find that it's always really helpful at the start of a project to walk through what everyone's role is, because with every project we... particularly at Pixar, we redefine our process. And what maybe on the last show was done this way, we're going to reinvent the wheel and do it a different way on our next show. And so we sit down, and it seems so basic, but we talk about what everyone's job is and their relationships to each other. And I think just having that moment of clarity really helps to avoid confusion downstream and potential conflicts over who's got what, who owns what. So that's worked really well for us. And ultimately, the deal breaker when we are having conflicts is the movie. So the question it always comes down to, what's the right thing for the movie? And that usually gives us our answer. So
great.
We do pre-mortems, and that gets everyone's deep-seated concerns about what could destroy the project, both personal and otherwise. And then we revisit those almost on a weekly basis to see if we're ticking them off.
Yeah, we do this. Can you hear me okay? Yeah. Yeah, I call it the prenuptial agreement. It's when everybody loves each other and you're anticipating all the things that can go wrong while you're still loving them. So when they do go wrong, you're like, oh, I remember we talked about that.
Yeah.
Okay, the next theme is do not negotiate with terrorists.
Parents should totally give kids exactly what they want when they're throwing tantrums, because, I mean, if they're, like, kicking and screaming and putting up a big fit, it's got to be important, right? I mean, like, why would they do something that extravagant if it wasn't important?
Really?
Yes.
What do you think?
I kind of want to stay out of this.
So that's my two daughters. You can tell which one might more often be in the role of a family terrorist. And the other one is the peacemaker. So I sometimes cheekily use that expression with my kids when I feel like they're headed down like this path of being totally inflexible and irrational and overly demanding. And they're, you know, headed towards a tantrum where they've totally lost control. And, you know, over the years, having, you know, managed teams for a lot of years now, there's definitely an interesting corollary to the workplace where, you know, you have, you know, potentially a very talented and a highly creative person who comes along with a highly volatile personality. And, you know, they may make unreasonable demands, or they have challenges working or collaborating with others. They have trouble receiving feedback in an appropriate way that could make their work better. And, you know, it's really can be a big challenge in the workplace, because it's so important, in the same way that you don't give in to tantrums with children, that you don't give in to tantrums at work. Not only because it's not good for the individual in the long run, because they don't like learn to kind of deal with you know, their own issues, but also because you can have really strong performers in that same context who observe that you're giving in, and they make a mental note, and then maybe their work that's done with a lot less drama is not not valued or rewarded or recognized, at least in their eyes. It can be very, very toxic in the team environment. And, you know, I think the way that it can sometimes manifest itself, like I said, is also, you know, not sharing credit for the work, you know, losing their temper or motivation when they don't get their way all the time. There's a lot of different ways that this, I think, can manifest itself at work. By the same token, I think it's really, really important, both with kids but also with members of a team, to look past the what's and into the whys. So most of the time when a kid, at least a younger kid, is, although it's amazing because now my son is 13 and this is still true of him, when he really starts to lose his shit, it's usually because he hasn't had enough sleep, he hasn't eaten well, his routine has been disturbed at some level, and like, he's a great kid, but if those things go wrong for him, it's very hard for him to keep it together and, you know, have some self-control and deal with like things not going the way that he wants them to. And adults at the end of the day are not that different. I mean, some of you may actually really have blood sugar issues. I'm not talking about that, although it can have an impact, but you know, with grown-ups, it's insecurities, fears, you know, maybe the person feels like they're in over their head, that they don't know how to be wrong, I think is really common, in particular with people who are really bright. Maybe they're in a job that they're actually not that well suited to, or in a role on a project that they're not well suited to. But it manifests itself in these behaviors that are really destructive to the team environment. I mean, I always say, you know, working at Google, you know, I'm in a company where almost everybody there was the smartest kid in their elementary school class. I mean, just think about a company with that many, like, super bright kids. And it can be hard because, you know, a lot of folks, and I'm sure I'm probably one of them too, you know, growing up, defining yourself as being right. It's the value that you bring. And but, of course, you know, 20,000 plus people can't all be right. And so it's an interesting kind of part of the creative and collaborative dynamic. So then the question is, how can you kind of manage the situation and keep it from poisoning the environment? And what I always tell myself, and it's the same with my kids, is the real opportunity is to take all of that energy and passion and creativity and then combine it with skills to deal with conflict, to understand how to let other people sometimes take the lead, to understand that you don't always have to win the arguments. And if you can help people grow and mature, whether they're 3 or 35, that you're giving them a huge gift and potentially the world a gift, because obviously as parents, the goal hopefully is to, you know, give the world evolved and progressive and happy and productive kids, and at work to teach people to get even more satisfaction and productivity out of what they do. And so the question that I have for my fellow panelists is, you know, what experiences might you have in dealing with, you know, kind of the problem child in the workplace, and what techniques have kind of worked to help either get them to a better place or to know when to cut bait? When is that talent actually not worth the drama that it comes along with?
You want to take that?
Sure. Well, it's interesting because at SAP, we do talent management software, and HR is often a function. We just merged with SuccessFactors.
You make them use the software as punishment?
No, but you... maybe. No. Not the new stuff. But that compliance part factors into bad behavior. Mm-hmm. At some point as a manager, you have to begin to document, because things can get bad. Mm-hmm. And I think we've all been in those situations where things get bad. At the same time, you now need to focus on the human. And I find that bad behavior often comes from fear. People are afraid of something. And if I can find what that fear is, mm-hmm. and they can come with me on that, mm-hmm. that we can begin to come up with coping mechanisms. Margaret and our kids go to school together, and their elementary education was really around social-emotional. Hypothesis being that, for the most part, kids are going to get everything they need educationally through the system. Mm-hmm. But social-emotional issues will derail them, and derail a lifelong love of learning. So how do we focus on those conflicts that happen on the playground, whether it's bullying or what have you? All those things affect one's capacity to learn or to perform or to behave. Yeah. And wow, bullies exist in the workplace. Things get mean and nasty in the workplace. So how do you help them cope? And that means that you have to, one, care about them a whole lot and want to salvage them, or if not, care enough about them to help them move on to another opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, as I'm listening, I agree with everything that you have both said completely.
It's okay, and we can disagree. We can deal with the conflict.
Yeah.
We'll work it out outside.
You.
The one thing that I'm thinking as I'm listening to you is that I always found it was important, if you have an outburst with someone, to address it immediately. So mm-hmm. I think that's something that we exercise constantly at Pixar, where if there's feedback to be given, we try to give it immediately mm-hmm. so the person is aware and there's time for them to react and maybe address. That goes both positive and negative. But when there is someone who's having an outburst, we try to call it immediately. And if it requires having a timeout, like, hey, go for a walk yeah. outside, like yeah. whatever it is, that's the stuff that we do in the moment. And it's also important to separate the behavior from the person. Mm-hmm. So as you're giving that feedback, it's not about them, but it's about that behavior. And the behavior is not okay. It has nothing, because I think it plays into that fear thing where mm-hmm. if they're fearful of something and their confidence is low, it's important to let them know that, hey, you're doing a great job. We value you for what you do, but that behavior is not acceptable here. And then over time, you know, if this stuff does keep happening, mm-hmm. then we document it and we go into, if we have to get into an extreme situation, we pull a performance improvement plan where we will coach and evaluate intensively over a 3-month period, a 6-month period, and hope that person comes out of that, you know, whatever it is that sent them into that PIP plan. And having managed a number of PIPs, I'm happy to say that a lot of people do come out of those successfully mm-hmm. and are still at Pixar, but I think that's how we generally approach dealing yeah. with the tough personalities.
Yeah. I think two things. One thing that I've learned in my career is that one bad employee can suck all the energy out of the room. Doesn't that's matter right. how big of a company you are, whether you're 10 people, 20 people, 50 people, one person could do a lot of damage. Yep. So that's something yep. I learned the hard way in my early career. There was a really talented designer I didn't want to let go, but he made people cry. And eventually you just have to say, you know what?
It's just not worth it.
It's not worth it. It doesn't matter if you are the best designer in the world that you're going to make this company a lot of money. If you are going to make the people around you miserable, especially in an environment that is meant to be collaborative, you have to say goodbye to that person. So that's something to have the courage to say goodbye, even if you feel like that person is critical to the success of your project.
Well, Marie, but just before, the one thing I will say, there is, in particular in the creative fields, I think this mythology that in order to be like a giant creative that you need to be a giant ass.
Yeah.
And it's not true.
Not true.
It's an excuse usually mostly used by kind of mediocre people to kind of deal with their own fears and insecurities. And occasionally, yes, you get, you know, the top echelon of geniuses who, you know, don't have the time to be respectful, good colleagues, but for the rest of us mortals, like, you can't be a jerk. You yeah. just can't. You're not going to do well in a team environment.
And then the last thing I want to say is, it's really, whether you're a manager or a parent, sometimes it's really good to admit when you are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a parent, sometimes your shit gets in the way of good parenting. You're angry, you're tired, you're hungry, and you yell at them for where you could have had a rational conversation. Same is true as a manager. It's really good to apologize when you realize you're wrong.
How many people have had parents who actually apologize back in the good old days? I mean, it's a rare event.
Zero on zero.
This, for me, was a very personal decision to make sure that I recognize that when I've made a mistake as a parent, and I try to bring that into work.
Yeah.
Well, and we're segueing to this topic, but for me, particularly with my kids, but also at work, it's really important for me to somewhat nonchalantly like fail in front of my kids mm-hmm. and my teams and just yep. be like, God, I totally screwed up that yep. meeting, whatever, yep. so that they become more comfortable with it as well.
Great segue.
No problem.
Thank you.
Sure.
Let's see. All right. Here we go again. Sorry, this is unelegant for a designer to do.
Problem solving
yes,
on the fly.
Yes, but we are problem solvers.
Hi, guys.
It's not working.
Hello, ladies.
Can you hear? No, can't hear it.
Success.
Oh, there we go.
Awesome. Happy. Improving or being something you say when you better. Win a video game. What about failing? How does it feel to fail?
Really sad.
Failure's not fun.
We worked hard for something and we didn't get it.
Have you guys ever learned something for failing?
Yes,
many times.
Mistakes equal information.
You have to learn how to, like, deal with bullshit. You don't have to learn how to deal with
mistakes. Whenever you make a mistake, don't get sad.
It's a tweetable moment.
It's just, it's not your fault that you made that mistake. It's just that you didn't know.
Thank you, guys. That was fabulous.
Bye. Enjoy the conference. Ted Ross!
Oops.
How about South by Southwest?
South by Southwest.
Rocks.
They made a mistake. And they recovered.
Okay.
Of.
Thank you. That was worth it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, we're running tight, so I'm gonna throw out some real questions around failure. Because failure is part, as you know, failure equals information.
That is a quotable quote.
I know.
Yeah, it is.
That's a tweetable tweet moment. From my daughter, Olivia Allen. we were kind of talking about this a little earlier today about, you know, you can look at failure as a horrible thing in a company, and depends how you're failing, or you can look at it as an opportunity for learning or experimenting or trying things out. And it's important to try things out and sometimes say, you know what, that was a really bad idea. And I do it all the time. I consider myself the lead designer of the business, and I try things on 80 people that sometimes are quite painful. But I'm like, oh, wasn't a good idea. But you move on, and you try those things. So at HOT, we're really comfortable with failure because we feel like failure is part of innovation and design and the process. But there are some companies and cultures who don't really have the same approach. So I wanted to ask you all, like, what is your company's point of view on failure? What does it mean for the company? What does it mean for the employees? And then how do you help people learn from their mistakes?
Speaking for Pixar, Pixar is a very friendly and informal place. We work really hard on building rapport among the studio, and we have lots of crazy events, scavenger hunts and bring ball pits in and make snow slides, and we do all sorts of ridiculous stuff. But for the point of having people just sort of bond over something ridiculous, and I think that stuff, while in the moment may seem silly, what it does is it creates a rapport and almost a sense of family in the studio, and that then contributes to the studio being a safe place where you're familiar enough with everyone, it's comfortable enough, and you can take risks in whatever you're doing, and it's okay to fail. So we support it. To counter that, I think that Pixar, maybe a little bit like Google, is filled with a lot of people that are incredibly driven, and it's very hard for them to fail. So even though it's okay, they will still drive themselves to build something that's bigger and better than whatever it was that we intended to do just for the sake of doing it. And when they fail, you know, we acknowledge it, and we try to work with them to set them up for the next thing that they're planning to do. Definitely not penalized for it. Although I think some people, if they have grand failures, choose to leave the studio. I think it's hard. It's hard for them to stay.
Well, I don't want to necessarily, I mean, Google is such a large organization. There's a lot of diversity in the way that the different groups are run. So I don't want to make any kind of blanket statements about what the attitudes are towards failure, because quite frankly, I think it's hugely indicated by individual managers and directors and VPs, right? The apples don't fall far from the tree. If your leaders are embarrassed by failure and get angry when things don't go well,
people, just like kids, learn really fast to not do that anymore because it makes mommy and daddy mad, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, for me, within my team, the one thing that I do know is that micromanagement is a recipe for failure, right? Like, in the same way that as a parent, I have to force myself to put my kids in situations where I know they're going to fail, you cannot be overprotective of your teams. You have to let them own stuff, and then sometimes it's going to go well, and sometimes it's not, and you have to be really accepting of all of those situations. Yes, help them figure out what the learnings are, but you cannot create an overly, I mean, we want to create a safe environment for experimentation, but not one that is like a rubber room. You know what I mean? And I think managers and parents both make that mistake.
Mm-hmm. I think SAP is an enterprise software company. It's very process-driven and very engineering-driven. I mean, much of the world's business flows through SAP systems. But I think in the recent past, we've brought design thinking. Hasso Plattner, who's the founder and chairman of the board, has invested heavily in the Stanford D School and other places to bring this fail fast, fail forward mindset to SAP. And I've been part of an organization and a product group that's been working on that. So you see experimentation, but it happens in safe environments, meaning where management is fully behind it, to Margaret's point. And they demonstrate it. You know, we have some really interesting experiments going on in the consumer space. We have Recalls Plus, which is actually appropriately targeted at recalls around children's items and things like that. Typically a place we don't play at all, but we've invested in that. We're shifting our notion to people-centric applications around how do you actually help people be successful in their careers or travel. Sort of a commercial, but not really. It's evidence that we're beginning to change. It means that we're not going to get the 1.0 perfect. We're going to focus on the minimal viable. It's more about business model innovation and how we pivot and change. This, to me, is the beginning of a innovation culture. Mm-hmm. And I won't even call it a tolerance for failure. It's a tolerance for innovation. Because if you're going to get to innovative technologies and breakthroughs, you got to make mistakes.
I'm sorry, right. I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing at the slide at YouTube.
The slide. Don't you want to have this in your office?
Although the problem we had was like we actually had several injuries because you catch air at the bottom of the slide going from the third to the second floor, and we had a few people who ended up
with
some lower back issues.
So I'm going to have I'm having an Oprah moment, and I would love to take questions from the audience. Could you give us your name? If you have children, what their name is, and what your question is.
Hi, my name is Dan. I have a daughter. She's 1 1/4. Her name is Becky. No. And, I think we all as parents, you have to pick your battles, as we all know. And but when you pick your battle, you have to win it. And and so I'm wondering, if you guys can help identify, at what point when you pick a battle and you feel like, you've tried, you guys have all talked very eloquently about some of the things you can do to try to bring along a person who isn't performing well or who isn't fitting in right. At what point can you identify how you determine that you've reached the point that it's time to really bring the hammer down and all the nice approaches aren't working? I mean, when do you feel like you've gotten to that point and how do you deal with that?
There are interpersonal ways to communicate with somebody along the way about whether this is the right place for them. And then, as Lourdes was talking about, there's also kind of, not in a bad way, the more bureaucratic side that you can actually document and track over time, right? So it's like, listen, this isn't about you. This isn't about me. This is about this job out here that you were hired to do and a bunch of data that supports that you are not able or willing to be able to do that job. So unless we want to change you into a different job, we need to be able to start doing these things. And I think to me, it's extremely individual. Some people really get when they're off track, and you can have that conversation with them, and it's open and honest. And other people have to have it written down on a piece of paper, and it has to be kind of gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
And it's wildly variable, right? Anybody who's been managing, me or you guys for 15 years, I've managed a lot of people out of organizations. the vast majority of them, I did not fire. Right? It was a process of mutually understanding this is not the right place for you. Ideally, finding a better place for them, but just recognizing like there's a job to be done, and if you can't do it, we need to address that. And again, sometimes you can have that conversation and there's good self-awareness on the other side, and sometimes it's not, and it's really hard.
Yeah, I was just going to say self-awareness. I think the person has to acknowledge and own the feedback that they're getting, and if they don't, I think that's the point where you realize there's no battle there, that the battle's lost already. Mm-hmm. Because if they're not willing to accept it, there's really not much you can do. You can influence, but you can't change. So I think that's what we use as a guiding principle.
Yeah, I think you have to be consistent and fact-based. You have to say, this is my expectation. Do you agree? And then when they continue down the same path that they did before that conversation, then it becomes another fact-based conversation. You know, I to me, it's a simple but complex process of being objective and very upfront. Now, with kids, we suffered no terrorists, so you're about to enter the terrible twos, which is actually threes and fours. and when they melted down, and they did, even when they were well-fed, well-rested, we were okay with extraction. That our experience at the, you know, farmer's market was not as important as teaching these guys a lesson. Yeah. And we didn't go to the now Will, now Henry tone. We went, all right, time to go home. Mm-hmm. Didn't get angry, just extracted.
Cut bait.
Go.
Anybody else? Name, yeah. Kids?
My name is Patty, and I have a daughter.
Is that on? Can you guys hear?
It's here.
Now she, yeah.
Okay. I have a daughter. Her name is Vivian, and she's 7 months old.
Cool name.
And I've been away for a week.
Oh.
Yeah. So anyway,
that could be a good thing.
Yeah. We're meeting for drinks.
You're
later.
getting sleep.
That's why I figure you have to embrace it while I'm gone.
That's
but
right.
How do you model the behavior you want in your team when you have to leave at 4:30 to get home for the nanny? Or
great question.
You know, your nanny has diarrhea, and then so does your daughter, and then your husband, and then you do. And so just like, how do you handle that? Like a stomach virus ripping through your house, and then at the same time telling your team, like, you know what? I don't care. You have to stay till the project's done. But then the rules are a little bit different in your circumstance.
We have all been there.
You know, this one is weird for me because I became an executive very early on in my career in a very young company where nobody had ever had babies before, didn't even know anyone who had babies. And I don't know what of my personality makeup forced me to be like, oh, good, I get to decide all the rules. And so I was like, this is what new moms do is, you know, I have a curtain in my room. I'm going to be nursing in the middle of my office. If you want to come into my office, then you may see more of me than you want to. I mean, that kind of stuff. And so part of it is not being embarrassed that you're a mother.
Yeah.
Like, just own it.
Own it.
And just be like, listen, I got to freaking get home because I have a teacher's conference. And guess what? That kid is way more important than that meeting. And if you don't think that's the case, then maybe you need to look inside your own situation. It's hard sometimes when you're in a male-dominated area because the fact is, in a lot of families, the moms will pick up a lot more of that. That's changing in some respects, but it's a reality that you kind of have to deal with. Mm-hmm. So I would say the other thing is to go work for a place where you have leaders, both male and female, who strike that same chord, mm-hmm. right? So like if you like have, you know, women and men who are executives who just say, listen, like I've got to go because my kid has a baseball team. Everybody else in the organization is like, that's the norm. Okay, yeah. I can do this. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do when you're the only person. If you are, you just kind of have to lay the law down and just and like kind of do it with some chutzpah.
Right. I think, you know, it's funny because the same issue applies to men, but for some reason, women feel it harder. Like, I'm being a bad worker, but the same thing happens to men. They want to leave too, but for some reason, they don't talk about it as much as we do.
So just to give the dad's perspective here, my kids were born. I was at a startup. The second day after they were born, my manager woman said, when are you back in the office? I think it's very situational, very contextual.
Yep.
And the reality is that men want this too.
Yep.
There's lots of pressures around performance and lack of empathy from either gender. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter.
Yep.
But it's about creating that culture. So I have a guy who had a new baby, and he's on 2-month paternity leave because that's the culture at SAP.
Yay.
Amen.
Okay, one more question. Name, kids, question.
Hi, my name's Brian. I have three kids, 12, 5, and 3. Their names are Noah, Jack, and Isabella. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between in your organizations between ownership of, say, an area of responsibility and influence? Mm-hmm. So the difference between control and influence, and your example about kind of the problem child in an organization made me think about it. In my organization, we have someone on our broader team, right, that I don't directly control or manage. Mm-hmm. And so how can you affect change in an area where you don't control it and you have to try to use influence?
Maybe I jump in here because my whole team's existence is an overlay. You know, I work as an incubator, and I have to try to work to get the mindset shift. I'm on the executive team, and I have to make sure that my peers get it. But I also work tangibly down at all levels of the organization, so I model this behavior. And I say my evil plan is that I'm going to brainwash you, and I'm up front. And by the end of the time of engagement, they are brainwashed. They've bought into it because I'm evidence-based. And that's that influence means that it's you have to make it win for that person. You have to come up with something that makes them successful. And I have my team, I said, you need to make other people great, and in the process, you'll be great. The struggle ultimately is who gets credit, but I believe in this, my kid said it, this sort of karma, that good things happen when you abdicate that, mm-hmm. that covet of winning and being recognized. Sometimes you do have to take a stand, but the more you're a cheerleader for other people, the more people will follow you.
I think sometimes, too, sometimes if one of my kids gets into a corner about something, if I invite them into the decision-making process, it is remarkable how they can turn a situation around. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, one of my kids is just like a really finicky eater, and so I started putting him in charge of planning dinners and helping, and it was amazing the difference that made, right? Where, like, a couple of things, where he, had investment in it, so it mattered more to him. But then also, like, if he cooked something and people refused to eat it, like his siblings, he could then empathize with what I had been dealing with him for so long. And in the workplace, and this can be really hard, especially if you have a conflict with somebody, to actually invite them into the process that you, because some of it is coming from you, right? It's like, I don't like this person. They're not, respecting what I'm doing. To actually invite the enemy into the conversation really challenging. But sometimes it's the best way to do it, because then it becomes less about you and me and more about, well, what do we have in common? In reality, you probably have a ton in common, and then there are a couple of personality or communication or process issues that are getting in the way.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And I told you it goes fast. It ran out of time. I hope that this was helpful for you. We really enjoyed talking to you mm-hmm. today. We will be at the bar drinking margaritas and bitching about our kids. So thank you very much for participating.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.